This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the blame for the poisoning of Flint, Michigan stretches all the way to the White House. Atlantic City is afraid that the state of New Jersey may treat them like Michigan did Flint. And a petition is awaiting your signature, charging the U.S. with genocide against Black people.
But first, Dr. Anthony Matera was one of the organizers of a conference on the Black radical tradition earlier this month at Philadelphia's Temple University, the school where Dr. Matera taught African American studies until he was fired for his radical activities. We asked Matera if the conference accomplished what the organizers expected.
What we expected, ultimately, was to impact the ideological and practical direction of not just the Black Lives Matter anti-police state movement, but what we see as the next stage of mass action, which will combine the anti-police state movement with a urgent movement for economic justice.
And do you think the presentations and the interaction between the parties at the conference brought that closer?
I think it did. I think if you look at the presentations and the panels among the keynote speakers, I think we came closer to understanding that it's not just a matter of police violence. It's a matter of an entire political economy, a system that is in decline, or a system that faces an existential crisis. And I think that perhaps was the high point of the conference. And in so indicting or critiquing the systemic crisis, we presented, although not fleshed out, the socialist alternative. Now, of course, our view of socialism is somewhat different than Bernie Sanders. We're talking about not just a New Deal type of socialism, but actually the nationalization of the banks, the appropriation of the trillions of dollars that they have gotten over the last 10 years, and so on. So we're talking about an economy that is centered upon meeting the needs of the people and not upon profit of individual corporations and banks.
And you're certainly not talking about a foreign policy like Bernie Sanders. This is an anti-imperialist as well as anti-capitalist conference.
Absolutely. And that was made very, very clear. Not only are we talking about a different foreign policy, but we were talking about the dismantling of the military, industrial, and police state structures in the United States. And we were talking about massive civil disobedience, not just a few people or 100 people, but massive civil disobedience that would take place over extended periods of time, where you make those who benefit from the police state and the military industrial complex pay a price, kind of like divestment, boycott, and sanctioning, but not just those involved in foreign policy, such as those supporting the state of Israel, but the same kind of approach to those involved in domestic policies that harm the people.
Although virtually everyone there was anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist, folks came from a variety of backgrounds and organizations. Were you surprised or pleasantly at the level of camaraderie that existed at the conference?
Well, it was very exciting to see that. I mean, except for a very small group who came with the intent of disrupting the conference, what was achieved in terms of unity was extraordinary. And, you know, we're beginning to see this in polling data, even in this presidential election cycle, and not to mention the Pew study some years ago, that majorities or significant pluralities of the American population, not to mention over half of young black people, identify themselves in one or another way as pro-socialist. I mean, this is perhaps unique in the whole history of the United States. The question becomes, how is that achieved? If people say they're for something, then what do they do to bring into existence, to bring into life the values and the beliefs that they hold?
Anybody could see that the demographic spread at this conference was extraordinary. People from all age groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the majority, overwhelmingly, maybe 70%, were below 40 years old. So it was a very young conference, as we expected it to be. And, you know, as you mentioned, the geographic spread. I mean, there were people from California and from Florida and from Georgia and from Peoria, Illinois, and from Missouri. So, as well as, you know, up and down the East Coast. So it was geographically represented most of the areas of the country where you have sizable black populations. So that was very rewarding.
Many of us throw around the term black left, but it's been so long since we've had a mass movement with a black left right up front that, well, the term may have lost its meaning. Do you think this conference in Philadelphia gave us more clarity on what it means to be on the black left?
I think the conference starts to do that. I don't know that all of the young people understand what that term means, the black left. Most of the young people, although they are objectively to the left, they see themselves as activists. And I think the term activist rather than left is the way they might identify themselves. But objectively, they are situated in the political left. Now, of course, we cannot overestimate the level of political and ideological development and consciousness of the young generation. We cannot do that. What we see is a growing militancy that perhaps will lead to a higher level of ideological understanding and political clarity that would then institutionally and organizationally place a good part of them in the left. And, you know, for example, when I spoke at the conference, I mentioned the idea of the need for a vanguard to emerge out of these movements. And I was using vanguard in a broad sense and in an organic sense. Organic to the people, in particular, organic to the black community, a part of the life world of black people. And when I say vanguard in the broad sense, we're not talking about a particular party as much as we are talking about an advanced leadership for the people that can tackle political and ideological tasks of this moment.
Historically, a portion of the white left, white people who call themselves socialist, have been quite uncomfortable with gatherings of black leftists who call meetings as black people.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And usually when black people take initiatives such as this, they're called narrow nationalist. In fact, although black people and our tradition is probably the most internationalist of any tradition in the United States, the most internationalist. The conference was about advancing radical politics, and it did assert that the single most consistent source of radicalism in the history of the United States is the Black radical tradition. There is no other tradition of radicalism. There are instances of radicalism and individuals and sometimes organizations that are radical, but there is no tradition except the Black radical tradition, which goes back to the anti-slavery struggle and is now hopefully re-situating itself in the 21st century.
I guess some proof of that is that May Day was invented in the United States, and yet most Americans don't even know the significance of that day.
Yeah, I think that's one part of it. But I think the other part of it is that few Black people and hardly any white people realize how radical the majority of Black thinkers have been. You know, Du Bois was a socialist all of his life, became a communist at the end of his life. Jimmy Baldwin was an admitted socialist all of his life. And we could go on and on. Our tradition, the tradition of Black thought and practice in the main, is a radical tradition because we don't have many options. And I think the situation today is such that the system is in such a profound crisis, and I would add that we're looking at probably another epic recession, a great recession in the not too distant future, that this means the options of reform in terms of resolving the real problems of Black people, the options of reform are very narrow, that to really solve the pressing problems of the majority of Black people, here we're talking about 80 to 90% of us, requires systemic change. And I think that is recognized by growing numbers of people, including growing numbers of young people, which in a big way explains the turnout for this conference.
Well, the conference showed that you can get 1,000 folks who call themselves socialists and anti-capitalists and anti-imperialists and who are certainly activists together in a place. Mm-hmm. But what more is needed? What's the next step?
Well, let me just say, we estimate that there were about 2,500 people when you take all of the events that were going on. But that's the question, what comes next? And you're right, holding a conference is one thing, but creating something beyond the conference is a whole other thing. And I don't know we have the capacity to fully realize all that we talked about at the conference. We're going to have to see. A lot depends upon the human factor, on the people that can be the leadership of carrying forward what the conference talked about, are they in place? So we have a lot of things to think about going forward. And I would just add that, at least from my standpoint, humility is paramount. We achieved something with the conference, but it was only a conference. It does not solve the problems of the movement, which are very profound and manifold at this time, including the fact that a good part of what is called the Black Lives Matter leadership has clearly gone over completely to the Hillary Clinton campaign and to the Democratic Party. And we've seen that pattern going back to 2008 and so on. So there are a lot of issues that the Black left will have to address in this next few months.
Yes, and in fact, that issue of the wooing and the acceptance of the wooing of the Black Lives Matter movement was not gone into in great depth at the conference.
No, it was not. It was not. In fact, you know, that's an interesting thing. Except for Umi Sela, who gives this brilliant speech critiquing social media celebrities and social media invented leaders, it was almost as though the conference assumed that that phase and that, and I put quotes around this, that leadership was behind us, that we are going to another stage of struggle. And very interestingly, and I think a lot of people would be surprised to know this, that the people who are touted by the media, the mainstream media, as the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement, are not known by name or otherwise by very many people, especially in the Black community. So they became leaders without having an army of followers. And so it was as though the conference was saying that we are on the cusp of another stage of struggle, and that is what we have to prepare for.
That was Dr. Anthony Montero speaking from Philadelphia.
Who is ultimately responsible for poisoning the water in majority Black Flint, Michigan? Black Agenda Report editor and columnist Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo says the blame stretches all the way to the White House. Dr. Coleman Adebayo blew the whistle on racism and corporate corruption when she worked for the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. She says what happened to Flint, Michigan goes far beyond environmental racism.
These are really crimes against humanity that we're looking at. Not that environmental racism isn't obviously a part of crimes against humanity, but crimes against humanity is when you totally and you completely decide that it takes a criminal orientation to address a significant portion of the population, that these are criminal acts. This isn't just simply being deceitful, dishonest, lying, wishing people ill. I mean, this is when you are looking at genocide, when you're looking at the most destructive elements that a society can bring to the table. And that's what we have in Flint, Michigan. This is the perfect storm of neglect, environmental racism, white supremacy, retaliation against whistleblowers, political cowardice. I mean, the failure to embrace just elemental concept of humanity, of both African people and disadvantaged communities. The Flint story, just like Katrina in many ways, is just this ongoing story of ethnic cleansing in the United States. And, you know, I'm so opposed to the word gentrification that I'm going to really try not to use it, because this isn't the gentry that's trying to dislodge. This is not just a small group class. This is, in fact, power that has made a decision that these people do not have the right to live. And so in Flint, Michigan, we see all these elements of power coming together and turning the other way and just saying, these people are not really human. They don't have the right to exist. You know, we will essentially pump sewage water. They can drink E. coli, fecal matter, elements of lead and all kinds of heavy metals. It just doesn't matter because they're not really human. They have no value. That is what the Flint water crisis is all about. And that's what it has to be understood for. This is a major issue for not only the progressive community, but I would just say people who care about humanity, that this is an issue that we all need to really focus on and pay a lot of attention to.
Yes, once you decide that a population needs to be moved, then you might go to any length to make their conditions not only unbearable, but unlivable.
But this is even worse, because this is unlivable in terms of people who are going to die from these acts, people who are going to be sick for the rest of their lives. This dealt with fetuses in the womb of pregnant women who drank the water, who, quite frankly, don't stand the chance now of having a normal life. You're talking about young children whose brains have neurotoxic levels of lead embedded in their brain tissue. I mean, Hitler could not have come up with anything more horrific than what we have. In fact, he did. I mean, there was certainly a lot of poisoning going on. But I guess what still takes people by surprise is when their own government participates in this kind of abomination. And that's what the Flint story is all about.
Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, the man who appointed the emergency financial manager, who gave the yes to the change in the water source for Flint, Michigan, he's catching a lot of flack now. But the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, of which you used to be a part, also is culpable in this crime.
What I think is just so hilarious. The rationale behind Governor Snyder is that he was looking for a cheaper source of water. This is that's what his, the person he appointed to look into this. You know, of all the places to cut costs, do you really want to cut costs when it comes to water? And what I think is somewhat humorous is that the water that they dredged out of the river was not the cheapest water they really could have found. They could have gone to Japan, Fukushima. They would have gladly piped in water from Japan to. So the question is just how cheap do you want to be, and to what extent do you just want to make sure that the residents of Flint, Michigan would never, ever get off their knees and they would never be able to have productive and normal lives. And some, of course, as I've said before, will die from this illness. The EPA, of course, has been a lot of attention paid to the officials in Flint. The EPA is the federal organization that oversees state and local governments, and it completely and totally abandoned its mission, and it completely and totally has been involved in a spin process of trying to point fingers and blame other people along the way for their inadequacy and their lack of integrity in this instance.
Yes, the regional manager for the EPA has stepped aside, but is she a sacrificial lamb for the agency at the top?
Well, she should have stepped aside. There's no question about that. She's a criminal. And not only should she step aside, but she should be arrested, she should be prosecuted, and she should be sent to jail for the tens of thousands of people in Flint, Michigan who are going to face the most hideous life that one can imagine because of the lead that's lodged in their brains now. But not only her, what about the EPA administrator? There's the buck stop over there. That's a stop with the EPA administrator, Gina McCarthy. And Gina, of course, from my perspective, threw Susan Hickman under the bus in order to save her own backside. But this is the history of EPA, and that's what I wrote about in my book, No Fear, because this is a corporation that almost from its inception was embedded with corporations, embedded with business interests. And so what you have in this instance is an EPA administrator in Region 5 that's basically caught being very inadequate and not only inadequate, callous towards black people, but that is the history of EPA in the Midwest region and across the country. And then, of course, President Obama went to Michigan to sort of tout the success of the auto industry. And while he was there, you know, made the comment that if he were a parent in Flint, Michigan, I think he'd be fit to be tied or some nonsense. But at the same time, we don't have any arrests on the books. We don't have him issuing or having his Department of Justice issue an arrest warrant for Susan Hickman or Gina McCarthy. So how sorry is he really about this mass wholesale poisoning of an American city? So I think we're going to have to demand that these people are arrested, not just allowed to walk out of EPA with a very attractive severance package and retirement benefits, and then, of course, wink, wink, they'll find them another job at Ford Foundation or some think tank. But these people have committed criminal acts, and we know it was intentional. We know that these were intentional acts. So what's the difference between literally pumping septic tank water, sewage, into people's homes for 2 years, and ignoring the outcry from the community about the smell and the taste and the color of the water, because quite frankly, you just don't give a damn about these people, knowing that down the road, these people are going to face the most horrendous medical challenges of their life, and you just simply walk away without any accountability for the people that you've destroyed their lives. I mean, if Gina McCarthy or Susan Hickman had been in a car and had run over people and destroyed their lives, they would be held accountable for that. But they can pump this water into people's homes, knowing that children are drinking this water, and then just get severance packages And in the case of Gina McCarthy, she's still sitting as head of the EPA in Washington, D.C. So it's really up to the public to decide if we're going to allow these different classes in the country to face different kinds of justice. I mean, we've got kids in prison for selling a joint, and here's a woman who allowed almost 40,000 people to be poisoned, and she was just able to tender her resignation and walk out of the doors of EPA. That just cannot work for us as a progressive community.
And the brazenness of the crime committed in full light of day. Everybody knew, everybody knows that the Flint River is heavily polluted. The public, the citizens of Flint have been complaining ever since the change was made. Regular people in the street knew of the foul nature of what people were being forced to imbibe in Flint, Michigan. How come the president can claim that he didn't know?
Of course he knew. After working in the government for 18 years, one of the terms that you hear all the time is you got to cover your ass. Cover your ass. And how do you cover your ass? The way you cover your ass in the government is that basically you document everything so that no one can say, you didn't tell me. So there's no question in my mind that Susan Hedman, who is a regional administrator, she's a political, she's someone who raised a lot of money for the president or whatever, and she was rewarded with this appointment, this political appointment in Chicago. So Susan Hedman, we need the emails. I'd love to see the email traffic between Susan Hedman and Gina McCarthy, because they're under orders to provide highlights of what's happening in their region on a week-by-week basis, sometimes it's day-by-day if you have major crises, but at least on a week-by-week basis, you know, you're sending emails up the chain to the administrator, letting her know that these are the major issues confronting your region. So we'd love to see the emails. But what we know is that Gina McCarthy knew about the lead poisoning for sure almost a year before the EPA email is exposed, is revealed. And we understand that her relationship with Gina McCarthy would obviously have the same kind of protect your backside relationship with the White House. And that is that she would not want the White House to be caught unaware of any major problems that are confronting the environment in the United States. So we would expect as well that some of these issues would also find their way in the briefings to the president. So all those issues still have to find their way to the public domain. But I think we're going to find a path all the way from Flint, Michigan to the White House on this, because that's just the way the government works. Everyone is trying to make sure that they cannot be accused of not letting their principals understand the problems confronting their communities. So I think that this story definitely has legs. And I think the fact that Susan Hedman resigned, it means that the White House, in fact, had to make a move. They had to address the outrage that's coming from across the country on Flint, Michigan. And so at this point, I think she's a sacrificial lamb, but let's see if it stops there.
And if ethnic cleansing, if black removal is in fact the policy of the United States, and clearly it is because it's going on in virtually every city and it's backed by the banks and facilitated by the government, if that is the policy, then atrocities, crimes such as this are inevitable unless the policy is halted.
Exactly. It's the logical sequence of ethnic cleansing, is that you are moving people from one area to another area because you're favoring, you know, one ethnic group over another ethnic group. And that's the reason why I don't like words like gentrification, because it really does, it disguises what's really going on in these cities. But I would just add that it's not just the United States. There's gentrification going on in Jamaica, where you have rich Americans and Europeans buying vast stretches of Atlantic seashore area, and they're also pushing Jamaicans, black folks, out of those areas to make room for the large hotels and the resorts. So gentrification is not just a United States phenomenon. It is a global phenomenon that's happening to black people, and I think that's important for us to recognize. But it's equally important for us to recognize and develop a strategy to fight the consequences of ethnic cleansing, because now you have tens of thousands of black people who were already struggling in Flint, Michigan, who now have a completely different, and in many ways, much more difficult struggle, because now they're struggling against their own bodies. And, you know, we just found out this week that, for example, Freddie Gray was dealing with lead poisoning. And supposedly he ate leaded chips when he was a young child. Of course, he had difficulty in school because it's hard to think when you've got lead in your brain, and dropped out of school when he was, I think, in the 10th grade because of, you know, learning disabilities and inability to focus, which is sort of on some of the primary symptoms of lead poisoning. And then, of course, in addition to being failed by the government in terms of being exposed to lead, then, of course, he's murdered by an agent of the state, a police officer. So he was coming and going. Freddie Gray was in serious trouble. And these families are going to find that it's very difficult to handle not only just a child who can no longer focus anymore, can no longer think in a very sort of logical and cohesive way, but now they're going to be up against a very difficult government bureaucracy when they try to access medical care, when they try to access mental health care. It's going to be very difficult, and it's going to be an uphill battle. And a lot of those same children in Flint will most likely, if our research, you know, holds up, find themselves in prison, because when they're not able to concentrate in school and get a high school diploma, then they have to make a living somehow. And that's when they're going to come up against killer cops or cops who are prepared to incarcerate them. So these young people have a lifetime of challenges.
And the dispersal of Flint's population, which was the original intent, can be expected to accelerate.
Not only Flint, but look at what's happening in Detroit, Michigan right now. I mean, we have a school system where the kids are in classrooms with rats as large as cats, with floors that are buckling, with, again, all kinds of, you know, environmental problems, you know, mold and just all kinds of environmental problems in the classroom and in the environment and the air. So this, as you said earlier, this is a national move for ethnic cleansing, just getting black people out, destroying people's lives and their livelihoods and their health. And this is not just limited to Flint. This is Detroit. It's Washington, D.C. It's Jamaica. There's a global move to destroy black life, particularly in the United States. And I think if you look at what's happening in Africa, I think we can probably lay claim to not perhaps ethnic cleansing in most parts of Africa, but certainly the level of poverty and disease and lack of water and resources that, you know, most people find themselves in on the continent. I mean, it is a global problem for black people.
That was bar editor and columnist Marsha Coleman Adebayo. Flint, Michigan's water problems began when the state seized power from the local government. Atlantic City, New Jersey is also facing a state takeover and the privatization of its water supply. Bar executive editor Glenn Ford reports.
After a state-appointed emergency financial manager poisoned the people of Flint, Michigan with tainted water, you'd expect that other governors would think twice before tampering with the water supplies of poor cities. But you'd be wrong. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie last year put Atlantic City under an emergency financial manager and gave him a year to slash the ailing gambling town's budget and prepare a full report. Kevin Lavin is a corporate turnaround expert with an international consulting firm. He was assisted in his dictatorial assignment by a fellow black corporate type, also named Kevin, Kevin Orr, who had just finished stealing the last vestiges of democracy from the people of Detroit on behalf of Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. In fact, every heavily black city in Michigan was taken over by Governor Snyder, effectively disenfranchising fully half of the state's black citizens. Apparently, Governor Christie thought that would be a good move for New Jersey, too, and he set his sights on Atlantic City, an overwhelmingly black and brown town that had just lost four of its casinos and is now about to lose another one. One-third of Atlantic City's 40,000 people live below the poverty line. With whites comprising only about 16% of the population, Christie must have reasoned that nobody important would stand in the way of whatever he wanted to do to Atlantic City. And he was right. Emergency Manager Kevin Lavin's report calls for regionalizing the police department and privatizing the fire department. But even worse, the Democratic president of the state Senate, Stephen Sweeney, has introduced a bill that would sell most of Atlantic City's assets, including its water department. But it gets worse than that. Not only is the top Democrat in New Jersey more enthusiastic about corporate privatization than Republican Chris Christie, but the president of the local Unite Here union has also endorsed the sell-off of city property and the further disenfranchisement of its citizens, many of them union members. Corporate Republicans, corporate Democrats, corporate unions all oppose the very concept of democracy, home rule, and self-determination for poor black and brown people. Indeed, New Jersey has a very long history of taking away power from local governments as soon as blacks and Latinos become majorities. The takeovers are always cloaked as necessary to avoid financial disaster. But since black and brown cities are perpetually out of cash, what it really means is that poor people don't deserve basic democratic rights. Ron Rice, a state senator from majority black Newark, sees the writing on the wall. "It's Atlantic City today, it's Newark tomorrow," he said at a rally against privatization. Senator Rice insists that we have to mobilize people and shut down some things and get back to doing what we did in the 60s. Which is true, but this time around, we must understand that everyone who serves the corporate master is the enemy, including black corporate hitmen, corporate Democrats, and corporate hacks in union clothing.
The International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement is circulating a petition charging the United States with genocide against black people. Movement President Herdosia Bintum says the petitions will be presented to the United Nations, which is holding hearings in Jackson, Mississippi, Chicago, New York, and Washington, D.C. The Uhuru movement has set up encampments in each of the cities. Herdosia Bintum explains.
The campaign that we are doing, this tour, it is the African Shores Genocide Encampment Tour. And we are going to be actually speaking in three of these cities to the United Nations. We're going to be doing a testimony, and we are having some of the victims' mothers that have lost their sons to police brutality as well going to be on this tour with us speaking why they are charging America with genocide. African Shores Genocide is a campaign that EPITUM launched shortly after Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson. We understand that this is genocide, and we understand that it's important for us to call it what it is. So the tour starts in Jackson, Mississippi. We actually sleeping outside in tents, you know, and it's just saying that we doing something extreme to get the not United Nations attention, but we want to get Africans' attention. We want Africans to know that this cold is nothing. It is not as brutal as the system that has been placed on our back for 600 years. So we will go outside and freeze our butts off so we can draw attention to the African community to understand that they got to charge America with genocide.
And you're also pushing for black community control of the police.
Yes, that's right. Black community control of the police is a Democratic request because we know that simply just having body cameras or simply just saying that the cops are going to go to sensitivity training or we're going to have review boards with no power. It do not speak to the real problem in our community, having occupying terrorists in our community that is not invested in the community, that comes in our community, say that they're looking for so-called crime. And we understand that these terrorists were always terrorists, and that's where it even came from, that they were slave catchers, and now we call them police. So we saying Black community control, it's not until the African people to the Black community have power that we will see changes in the way that we are policed. And the struggle can't just be that my life, you know, Black Lives Matter slogan. It can't be that. It has to be Black Power Matters. So yes, we say Black community control of the police now.
And of course, this is all caught up with the United Nations declaration of a decade of people of African descent.
Yes, they are going and supposed to be listening to different testimony, doing a study on African descent. As you just spoke, this is a working group in the United Nations just taking testimony. And I believe every testimony speaks to a different symptom of genocide.
Well, how many symptoms are there? How does genocide express itself?
Yes, it's all many different symptoms. Just to name a few, it's mass imprisonment, that they setting up camps. And we know that it's so many of our sisters and brothers, even our freedom fighters, that's in prison right now from a system just because they were just trying to stand up for their rights, that these rights that they say that we have, that supposedly in 1865, we were free and these rights were due to us, but they don't work. They're not for us. They don't speak for us. And, you know, the prison system, you know, and then this is a form of birth control, because if all our men are in the prison, then how are we making melanated African babies? And the school system, it sells our kids. Our kids go to schools. They self-hate. They don't be taught their real true history. They're taking words like slavery out the books. They don't know about people like Marcus Garvey to be self-determined. You know, they don't learn these things in our schools. So our kids hate themselves. They're not taught true history. They taught lies that have been fed to us for years and years and years that are not true, simply not true. These are just some of the symptoms, even the food. I mean, we need Black community control over everything, the hospital. So we're just dealing with a system that just, you know, really don't speak to the core problems of what Africans are faced every single day. So I encourage everybody to go to AfricanShoresGenocide.org, sign a petition. And before you sign a petition, look at the petition. And it actually does a great job to really go into depth of all the different symptoms that this is genocide, just from the word of genocide, what they say genocide is, and then showing it and proving it through what has happened to African people all the way up to 2016.
That was Hirdosha Bentham, president of the International People's Democratic Yahuru Movement.
5 years ago, Carl Dix and Dr. Cornell West co-founded the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, which has been confronting the mass Black incarceration state ever since. Dix says the network is holding conferences in key cities to map out plans for the next phase of struggle.
The movement of resistance to stop police terror, mass incarceration, and the whole slow genocide that's being sped up, targeting especially Black people, is continuing apace. I mean, look, there has been a beautiful rise in resistance starting with Ferguson, but the authorities have made clear they ain't backing off. And as we said with Rise Up October, three powerful days of resistance in New York City back in October, we have to take the movement of resistance to a higher level. So the Stop Mass Incarceration Network decided we were going to organize conferences on a regional basis in January to work out the plans and forge the organization to do just that. Conferences are going to be happening in New York City, Charlotte, North Carolina, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles in late January to do that, to forge plans and to develop the organization necessary to carry these plans out, to move, to bring forward the kind of movement that can stop the horror of police getting away with murder in this country.
Are these conferences involving folks that you've worked with over the past months and years, or are you broadening the base?
Well, here's exactly what we're doing. We are bringing together the people who have been involved in this fight, especially those who have worked in and with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, people who were involved in Rise Up October or impacted by it. And then around that, we are working to bring new forces into it. And a special focus of these conferences is going to be organizing a No More Stolen Lives tour. Tours that are especially going to focus on going to the campuses to bring the students in. Students have been stirring quite a bit over the last year. Some of them were active around the police murder of black people coming off of the Michael Brown murder in Ferguson. And then there was a higher level of activity around dealing with racism and white supremacy on campuses. But we're going to go to the students and say, you have a responsibility as the generation on whom the future rests. You have to take up the struggle the way that students in the 1960s took up the struggle around Jim Crow segregation and lynch mob terror and spearheaded bringing into being a broader revolutionary movement that rocked the system back on its heels. That's what we're going to take to this generation of students. And this No More Stolen Lives tour is going to take the question of stop police terror, which side are you on, powerfully to the campuses and to the communities and be posing to people that they need to be a part of this fight. Because right now, like in Chicago, they're actually openly talking about the legitimacy crisis that Mayor Rahm Emanuel faces because his administration is up to its neck in trying to cover up police murder of black people. Well, see, the deal is the whole United States system of government is up to its necks involved in unleashing, carrying out, and covering up the murder of black people. So the illegitimacy that Rahm Emanuel is facing applies to the whole system. And that's something that's got to be brought out to people, that this is what's been going on and that it went on even through two administrations of a black president and a black attorney general. This system continued to carry out genocidal assaults on black people. And then people need to, you know, act accordingly. We got to stand up and say that this must stop. And we got to be digging into why it happens again and again and what can and must be done about it. I'm going to be speaking at the conference in Chicago, and I'm certainly going to address that question of where it comes from and what must be done about it from the perspective that we need revolution, nothing less, to end all the horrors that this system brings down, and challenging people to get into that.
Yes, there have been lots of calls for Mayor Emanuel's resignation, but of course the system continues with or without him.
Yeah, see, that's exactly it, because Rahm should go, and everybody down under him should go, but that doesn't become, and then we replace Emanuel with somebody else and expect or hope that they're going to do us different, because this is really built into the fabric of the system, and they can't stop their police from doing it. I mean, you look at Chicago, it even points to that, because once it was exposed with the video of the police gunning down Laquan McDonald, and then lying that he attacked them, and then the video exposed that lie. You also had to deal with the fact that not only was the shooter complicit in that, but all of the cops filed false reports on that. The media reported those false reports like they were the gospel truth. The district attorney used them to exonerate the cops. And then it comes out that they've done the same dance again and again, with the murder of Robert Johnson that was also caught on tape, with the murder of Cedric Chapman, which was also caught on tape, with the cover-up of the murder of Darius Finex, even after the information about the cover-up got put through the court. So then after all of that happens, with all of that out front, police go out on a call the day after Christmas of a young man who is having a mental episode, and they end up gunning down the young man and gunning down a grandmother who just happened to live in that neighborhood and opened her door to see what all the commotion was when she heard the the shouting and got hit by one of the police bullets. They can't even stop their cops from carrying out murderous assaults because it's what they've been oriented and trained to do and what always gets covered up when they carry it out. And we got to learn our lessons from that. So Rahm Must Go being turned into an electoral campaign for some other Democrat or independent or whoever to replace Rahm and preside over the same setup is not going to end the horror of police murder. We need a whole new system, and that's going to take revolution.
And of course, policing and mass incarceration is a national system that exists with remarkable uniformity across the country.
Yeah, that's exactly true. I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, Laquan McDonald in Chicago, but then there's Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Eric Garner in New York City, Sandra Bland in Texas, Natasha McKenna in Virginia, and I could go on that. It is a nationwide horror. It goes down whether it's Republicans or Democrats presiding over it. And people need to stand up and say, this must stop. And everybody with an ounce of conscience needs to do that. But they also need to dig into why this happens again and again and again and what we must do to stop it. And as we stand together to fight it, I'm going to be bringing that message that this system has this built into its fabric, the way it has many other horrors built into its fabric. Wars for empire, destroying the environment of the very planet, attacks on women, attacks on immigrants, and everybody who wants to be a part of that needs to check this out and get to the conference in their area or at least get a report from it if they can't make it to the conference. And to check this out, you can go to the website stopmassincarceration.net or Rise Up October. Both of them will be carrying information on this. And if you want to get into this question of what it's going to take to stop horrors like police terror and mass incarceration once and for all, you can go to the website revcom.us because I'm speaking on that question in written and video form quite a bit.
This is the last year of President Obama. He's gotten lots of credit in some circles, deserved or not, for his response to what we broadly call the Black Lives Matter movement. Is it deserved?
It's definitely not. And see, it's Obama playing the role that he was put in place to play, and that is to draw us back into the system, draw people who became disaffected back into the system. Because let's look at what has happened as far as Black lives on his watch. Police have continued and even intensified brutalizing and murdering people. And how many police have been charged for their murderous deeds by Obama's Justice Department, whether that was Eric Holder or Loretta Lynch? Exactly zero. None of the police who brutalized and murdered people on Obama's watch have been brought to federal charges, and almost none have been brought to state and local charges. And the feds do a lot of investigations, but those investigations are just to placate us and let the steam off. And then when we forget about it, when people have moved on, then the Department of Justice announces they're not going to bring charges the way they've done again and again in these murders. Also, on the question of mass incarceration, Obama has let a few people out of jail. But let's actually deal with what's going on here. 2 million plus people, almost 1 million of them are Black. Hundreds of thousands of those people, Black, Latino, white, are in on nothing more than possession of banned drugs. At worst, a medical problem, not a criminal one. But these people have been criminalized. They have been put in the warehoused in prison. And then when they get out, they're going to be classified as less than full citizens and full human beings, saddled with all the things that you're denied because you're a felon: job opportunity, housing, education. This has continued under Obama, and a speech or two or a visit to a prison where they've cleared the prisoners out of the part where Obama is, does not deal with the way this system has criminalized and demonized whole generations of especially Black and Latino youth. That's what's needed. And if people fall for a few kind words or honeyed words from Obama, then they're being taken in by a system that has presided from the very beginning over treating Black life like it does not matter, and has continued to do that all the way up to today. Black Lives Matter needs to actually get at why have Black lives not mattered and what needs to change in order for them to matter. And that change is not going to be sitting in the White House. That change comes down to what kind of system are we going to be living under.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.